This talk is given by Vanessa Zuise Goddard, a writer and lay teacher based in Panama City, Panama. Zuise is also the guiding teacher of the Ocean Mind Sangha, a virtual community of Zen practitioners. And this talk, like all of her talks, is offered freely. If you'd like to offer a donation to support Zuise's work, listen to other talks, or find out more about the Ocean Mind Sangha, please visit us at oceanmindsangha.org. Thanks for listening.
So, again, welcome. Welcome to the Ocean Mind Sangha. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome to our little Buddha field. I was thinking that, you know, we have been very patiently, very diligently building together this field for a few years to help dispel the miseries of the world, as the great Indian teacher Shantideva said. And I was saying to somebody just the other day, living is hard. We know this, of course, as a central teaching in Buddhism, that life is suffering. Living is hard. Living in our world, living in our own minds, living with one another is hard. It's hard when we love or like one another. It's even harder when we don't see eye to eye. Harder still when we don't understand what drives us. And so then we just react to every passing wind. And, you know, the world is burning with so many fires right now, of course, literal, but also figurative. And sometimes I think, at least I find, sometimes it's challenging to know, you know, where to even begin to try to put them out. But I think, in fact, you know, for us, at least that much is clear. You know, we begin where we always do, right where we sit, right where we stand, right where we live. First, by doing our utmost to understand how it is that our actions contribute to or help solve the problem. And then doing our utmost to have what we do, what we say, what we think, all fall on the side of the solution. The Buddha said, you know, I teach one thing, suffering and its alleviation. He was rare among spiritual teachers. He taught for 40-some years. And he said, I teach just one thing, the truth of suffering and its alleviation. I think of the incredible work that some people do, that they dedicate their lives to. Finding a cure for cancer or Alzheimer's. People who are trying to figure out how to blot out the sun to temper global warming. People who are developing laws to give waves, to give a wave personhood so it can be protected from us people. People who are studying the consciousness of animals and discovering that they're actually much more like us than we ever thought. You know, that birds dream about singing. They rehearse their songs in their sleep. How incredible is that? That turtles have personalities. They can be chatty, they can be cranky, so they vocalize to get each other's attention, to get human attention. So I've been reading a book about turtles, about a particular group that rescues all kinds of turtles, particularly endangered ones. And so they live very closely with them. So they vocalize. One of them gets huffy if you pull him out of his soaking tub too soon. That dogs can smell the passage of time and therefore pinpoint almost the exact time their owner will walk through the door. I read about a dog that would meet the evening train at exactly the same time every day. And he did it for 10 years, even after his master stopped showing up, because he sadly, unexpectedly died at work. But the dog knew what time it was. I was reading this. I thought, well, you know, some dogs, Lucas doesn't seem to be endowed with that particular gift. Or if he has it, he keeps it on the down low. Because he always seems surprised when Kira walks through the door. You know, and then I think of all the many people in cities and towns and villages all over the world who right now are taking a little bit of time to get still and quiet. Who are taking the time to see and ask and to try to understand what is not yet clear about their minds, about their bodies, about their hearts, and those of others. And it's very humble work in one sense, right? Very ordinary. It's also humbling work and therefore potentially profound. Every time we ask ourselves, what if what I see is not all there is? Every time I say, I'm sorry, I hurt you. I was scared, I was confused, I was anxious, and I'm very sorry that I put that on you. Every time we ask, how can I help? What can I do? Where can I serve? We're doing work as urgent as that life-saving work of a doctor or a climate scientist. Because this work is life-saving too. And I think some of us know that in our bones, in our cells. Some of us have seen it save us or someone else. One of the great, great privileges of doing what I do is to see how the sincere wish to understand ourselves can change profoundly sometimes a person's life. And by extension, often change the lives of those around them. And so we've been reading Loving Kindness in Plain English by Bhante Gunaratana. And we're getting to the end of the book. And many of the teachings we're reading in these later chapters, you know, we're familiar with. The unconditionality of loving kindness. The recognition that we all suffer, and therefore all beings are worthy of respect and love and compassion. The power inherent in living in such a way that we wish each other well, despite the fact that others' actions might not point in the same direction. Again, something so simple and so profound. And one thing that I was thinking as I was reading this again is that in order to really see, in order to really feel the power and the effect of loving kindness, we have to spend time together. We have to spend time together because as much as we need the aloneness of meditation, for example, the ability to be in one's own chamber, as Pascal once said, we also need togetherness to understand one another. I mean, it seems obvious, but I don't think it is. Not anymore, given how we're choosing to live more and more. right? I need to see you. I need to hear you. I need to be with you. I need to smell you, as my teacher used to say, to understand your experience, which in many ways is no different from mine. I mean, it might be different in the particulars. But not so much in its basic fact. And the fact that all things arise, persist for a bit, and pass. All things, good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant, what we move towards, what we move away from. All things arise in response to a set of circumstances, to a series of conditions. And then they are what they are for a bit. And after a while, invariably, they disappear. They pass. They change. A basic fact of life. And so although you and I may struggle differently, you know, some people get anxious, zingy, when things get uncertain. You know, maybe I get quiet, I shut down. You lean toward anger if you don't get your way. Another person becomes resigned. But the fact that we struggle is universal, as is the fact that we can work with that struggle. That fact has nothing to do with race or gender or age, nationality, religious belief. We struggle because we are. This is what the Buddha saw. This is why, I believe, Buddhism is still relevant today. So when it comes to loving kindness, you know, part of the trick to practicing loving kindness is we have to get past the surface appearances, and to really look at what's happening under the lid, as it were. And that we also recognize how we might be making things harder than they need to be. We know there is pain. We know that is inevitable. It's part of being a living, sentient being. And we know there is suffering, which we create. And we don't have to. A fellow teacher was saying today that some members of Congress are advocating to withhold disaster relief funds for California. The argument being that state and local governments should take care of these events. I mean, one particular congressman actually went as far as to say that FEMA shouldn't exist, that it's a misuse of federal funds. It's not our problem, in other words. And as I read this, I thought, how does this help? Like this increasing isolationism, this false belief that I'm only responsible for me, my loved ones, and no one else. That building walls to keep others out will, one, do that in any meaningful way, and two, actually lead to happier, more fulfilling lives for those on the inside. How is it that some part of us or some of us still believe that might be true? I shared with a couple of you, I've been reading an article in The Atlantic that was pointing to the fact that so many of us, in this case specifically Americans, are choosing to spend more time alone, often in front of our screens, than with one another. And the effect that this is having on everything from politics to our brains. This increased level of aloneness, chosen, for the most part, chosen aloneness. So, you know, we used to go to the movies. My brother and I, when we were growing up, we probably went 3-4 times a month with our grandparents. And later as a teenager, you know, I would easily go probably every week, you know, with friends, with partners. Now, if I go to the movies once or twice a year, that's a lot because I do all of my movie watching at home. So apparently now, you know, the average American watches 19 hours of television a week. And that's probably a little bit on the low, a low estimate. Roughly about 8 movies a week at home. Eating out, same thing. There are restaurants that now have closed off parts of their business and reserved it just for takeout. You know, so people just come in, grab their stuff, go out. They don't even have to interact. So they can eat at home while watching TV, learning a new language, playing sports, volunteering. I mean, they've all really declined, and in some cases, precipitously over time. And of course, you know, then I thought of us. You know, I don't know what the statistics are for meditation, but it's clear. It's clear that after the during and after the pandemic, you know, many people move their practice homeward. We are one example, of course. And I do think about this. It keeps me awake sometimes. You know, I wonder, is like, are we contributing? Am I contributing to the problem by choosing to practice in this way? And there are reasons, there are good reasons. For me, at least, you know, to choose to practice in this way. But am I contributing to the problem? The problem being, you know, the result of spending so much more time at home than in the world, a growing sense of disconnection from nature. And I remember even in my last few years at the monastery, when I was working in Zen Kids, I saw this change in the kids. They didn't want to get dirty. They didn't want to get wet. They didn't want to get hot because they just weren't used to it. And it was uncomfortable. I mean, as a kid, you couldn't keep me inside. I still sometimes bristle at the very work I've chosen to do because I have to be indoors. And I love to get, you know, good and muddy, caught in the rain, just because I could. But for them, it was uncomfortable. It was uncomfortable. And so one big effect of our hermeticism is our inability to tolerate discomfort. Because, of course, at home, everything is controlled. Our inability to relate to others, to build the social relationships that we need, that we depend on to thrive as human beings. A breakdown of boundaries and the exhaustion that comes from that. Because even though we're choosing to spend more time alone, we're not spending that time with ourselves. A lot of the time, we're looking at others on social media, for example, feeling often disappointed, lacking, falling short, and exhausted because we don't have enough time to recharge. So the author was saying it's like we're a walking battery that is always stuck in the red zone. And then he pointed out young men especially are among those who are spending time alone. And they do that watching television or playing videos. But because of their increasing sense of needlessness, he called it, you know, the sense that they are not needed in their families, in their communities, that sense of having a purpose, there's more depression. There are more deaths from overdoses. And I think perhaps most tellingly, you know, we're losing our ability to make space for others in our minds. Because we have fewer and fewer opportunities to spend time with people who aren't like us. You know, so when you take a class, when you go to the gym, when you join a club, you know, sometimes you spend time, you have conversations with people who do not think like you. Right? And as we're losing those opportunities, we're losing that exposure. We're losing exposure to other ways of seeing the world, which results in what? More defined, you know, categorical thinking. There is us and there is them. There is right and there is wrong. And then add to that artificial intelligence, where you can actually establish a relationship where no one ever disagrees with you. And people are doing this, establishing all sorts of relationships, romantic friendships with a machine, you know, programmed to respond to your needs, your emotional needs, to affirm your opinions. At some point, you know, the space between us may get so wide, we may have a hard time closing the gap. You know, so again, I think about us and, you know, my hope, my vow certainly is to use this digital space to deepen our connection, first with ourselves, and then with one another. It's to make a space available for people who wouldn't be able to practice in a committed way otherwise, because of different circumstances. You know, and I'm not naive enough to think that it replaces in-person interactions. I know for sure, almost, that we would sit more together if we had a space to go to. Somebody had to open the door, turn on the lights, light the candle on the altar. You know, it's harder when we do it like this. If we had a place to find each other, you know, quite literally, and to work together and to run into problems as we try to work together, because we don't always see eye to eye. And then working past those differences and into common ground. I mean, this happens in this way too. But it does nag at me because I don't want us to play at practice. I don't want us to do like make-believe practice, right? Particularly with sitting, because without it, without at least some intensive sitting periods, everything we do, everything else we want to build is on shaky ground. And so I trust that when we don't come together, that at least we're sitting deeply on our own, or that we're finding people to sit with. And then, of course, on the other hand, aloneness is not all bad at all. It's actually quite helpful. Without the ability to be with ourselves, spiritual practice becomes very difficult, very challenging. So we need to be able to do that, and to face the ups and downs of our minds, the restlessness of our bodies, and to stay steady enough to get to the other side, to discover what's on the other side. I think that is also true of technology. It is not all bad by any means. I mean, it's done incredible things. And then the article had a, I think, an important argument. The author was pointing to the Amish who choose which technology to use to further the way they want to live. And so they may have refrigerators and washing machines, but they don't have radios or televisions because they want to keep those interactions alive and at the forefront of their living together. And he was saying, you know, although technology does not have values of its own, adopting it, we can create values. He said, for decades, we've adopted whatever technologies removed friction or increased dopamine, essentially making life easy for ourselves. He says, but dopamine is a chemical, it's not a virtue. And what's easy is not always what's best for us. So we should ask ourselves, what would it mean? What would it mean to select technology based on long-term health rather than instant gratification? And if technology is hurting our community, what can we do to heal it? So this is very much a question that I want to have at the forefront of my mind. You know, as we continue to evolve, as you know, we're moving through this process of becoming a nonprofit. The Ocean Mind Sangha is now a corporation. Thank you to Guy and his help with this work. The next step is to apply for tax exempt status. And so, you know, we continue to evolve using the technology that we have. I truly hope for good. I've said to you many times how my teacher, my first teacher, Dada Roshi, would say, if the Buddha had had a computer, he would have used it. I hope he's looking down on us and blessing this auspicious endeavor. But interestingly, one of the answers that the author himself gave, you know, for what do we do, you know, to ensure our long-term health is ritual. It's ritual. You know, the one thing that, of course, we know and that we do together. And that's what ritual is meant to do, is to bring people together. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be religious. You know, some of the secular rituals, it's something that you do consistently enough, like the weekly movie night or the monthly book club or the bi-weekly visit to the gym, the biannual retreat. Ritual is observance. And observance, of course, can be as simple as taking someone in. But that is a little harder to do on screen, unless you're one-on-one. And then there are all those brief, but no less important moments in our lives. You're standing in line at the cash register, or waiting at the doctor's office. You start a conversation with a stranger. On a plane, on a train. You know, that moment where you just smile at someone and ask them how their day is going. And it is quite ironic for me to be saying this, I confess, because I often choose silence among people I don't know particularly. But I also know the power of connection. I've been getting, for some reason, I don't know, it's something about the beginning of the year, I've gotten a couple of emails from people that I hadn't heard from in, I don't know, two decades. We connected at the monastery over a meal, probably, had a conversation. And they remember, and they thought they would reach out, you know, looked online, which is something we can do, found us and reached out. I remember moments where a stranger quite effectively saved me with a look, with a kind word. And so, you know, it's really that acknowledgement that in the moment of stepping out of ourselves, we're acknowledging our interconnectedness and making it, not making it real, it is real, just highlighting it. And the moment when we step out of what is comfortable, what we're saying is, right, this moment is not just about me. To connect means to bond, right, to tie together. And so in a moment in which we do that, what we're highlighting is what brings us together, not what sets us apart. And if we've ever needed that more than now, I don't know what that moment would have been. So maybe one way to think of loving kindness or an aspect of loving kindness is to think of it as the practice of togetherness. Whether physical or not, physical is good just because of what happens, you know, on so many levels. But that coming together, however briefly, for a moment or for a lifetime, to nurture what brings us close. Those of you who read the chapters we were reading know that Gunaratana, that's what he was pointing to in the stories he told of his own experience of practicing loving kindness, the effect that it had on him and his community. They were very simple stories. You know, someone offering a chair to first a stranger and then an acquaintance and then perhaps a friend as he continues to walk on the grounds near his monastery. To not retaliate when somebody responded to him and his community with antagonism. To keep all beings' well-being in mind, and to make that a practice. Because, you know, most of the time when we involute, when we retract, we do so out of looking for a safety, right? A sense of safety. But does it really give us that? This unbalanced aloneness. The article argues that it doesn't. And I think Buddhism would say the same. Because what is insular is fragile. And if you have a whole chain, it's much stronger than a single link. And so, my question to you in the few minutes that we have is, what practices can we use, do you use, to close the gap of our apparent separation? When we do take a risk and we reach out and it doesn't go well, because what we encounter is friction, how do we work with that impulse to just rush back into our shells? Be like, no, never again. You know, how do we repair a link that got bent or broken? How do we inspire ourselves to not just do what is easy? What comes easily.
For more talks, to get more information about Zuise's teaching, or to join her email list, visit us at oceanmindsangha.org.